It would be a pleasure then to ask Brother Andy to speak to us on the subject, Understanding the Children of Israel through Old Testament Stories. Brother Andy, please.
Good evening, Coventry. Hello. Thanks for inviting me back. Thanks for having me back. Sorry I can't be there in person, but hopefully we can still get plenty of things done this evening as well. See, there's quite a few online. So hopefully we can all get a bit of Bible study together, as well as a beneficial time all together. What I will do is I'll start my presentation now, and then hopefully we can move on through it accordingly. As I say that, as I try to do it too many different ways. There we go. Can we see it? We can, and do that. Yes, there we go. Right, can everyone see? Can I get a thumbs up that that's working? Please. I can't see anybody's thumbs up, so somebody can just say yes.
Yes.
That'd be helpful.
Can you hear us, Andy? Yes, working.
Working, brilliant, fantastic. Good, somebody's there. Brilliant. Right, okay, so we are going to be talking about understanding the children of Israel through the Old Testament stories. So when Sophie was booking me in to do this, I had no idea really what topic to really pick. So I'm really quite pleased that I had that opportunity. What I've put together is it's actually a thread of three different exhortations that I've written, and they all seem to have a similar constant throughout them. And I felt that they were quite beneficial to kind of put together. So I am trying something somewhat new within this, and hopefully that you can all benefit from being, experimental victims of something I'm trying to do here, but we'll see how we go. Okay, so what we're going to see is we're going to go through a number of different stories. We're going to take us through a different path, through a number of different stories, and really we're going to look at the purpose of why we're looking at stories. Why am I talking to you this evening about stories? And we're going to pick three particular stories out that as we go, hopefully we can pick some of them out. I'm hoping that people will be familiar with at least two of them. David and Goliath being read at the beginning hopefully will give you a starter as well. As I said, they are intended to be stories that we can all learn from. They are there to educate and give us something to talk through as well. But the reason that I want to kind of lead into this is just to be able to give us that, the understanding of the people of Israel. So what's the purpose of stories? Why are we given stories in the Old Testament? Why are we able to to sort of read the scriptures and understand these things? There's three things that I really want to talk about, and they are the purpose of the stories that give us are they lead us into a connection. They give us a connection from the storyteller to us in a very direct, but usually a very visual way. We see language that's used that helps us to picture it in our own mind. We often have words that we get given that our minds form all the pictures around it. So if I said to you a sword, you can probably pick that out. I don't need to tell you how long a sword is. I don't need to tell you how heavy a sword might be, what the purpose of a sword might be. I don't need to tell you who might be using a sword. There's a lot of connections that you instantly get from very simple language that we get to use through stories. They're beneficial for all ages. And it might be possible that we actually forget how important stories are. And I'm hopefully going to circle back round to the purpose of stories by the end of this time with you together anyway. But they build that connection, and they do so. The purpose of trying to give you that connection is that they deliver a message. There's some kind of story in the story. There's a point of telling you something. When my four-year-old tells me stories that just don't really make any sense whatsoever, and they just constantly ramble, there's usually a point somewhere in the middle of his stories. It takes me a while to get to that, but it gets there. So the more established storytellers are able to build their message, within the framework of that story. And we get to see a lot of these throughout scripture. We could spend all night talking about stories within the scriptures. So you'd be thankful that I've picked three. But the purpose that we also have is that there's always, or let's say always, there's usually a deeper meaning. There's usually a first instinct of a message that's trying to get put across, but usually a deeper meaning that comes below the surface too. And that's something that you take away and you think of yourself. Stories are a gift that we get to take home with us and ponder and consider ourselves. And sometimes we can hear the same stories many times and we get to hear different stories and different points of view each time. There might be some new things that we come out tonight for you, and I'd be interested to know that as well, if there is time for questions at the end. But otherwise, these are the purpose of stories. This is why we're giving the stories within the Old Testament, throughout the Old Testament, and even into the New. The stories give us these connection that God has given us this information to give us a message and for us to consider a deeper meaning too, and often relevance for ourselves. So I'm hoping to kind of go through a lot of these things together. So what we're going to talk about first. So David and Goliath, firstly. So David and Goliath, which we've covered within that reading that Kevin's done for us, is in 1 Samuel 17. There's quite a few things that we want to pick out from it. And I don't want to spend an awful long time looking at David and Goliath, because I think we might be aware of the story already. But below the initial story that we get of Israel fighting Philistines and David killing Goliath, there are some deeper stories that we can pick out, which are those kind of deeper meanings, those kind of connections that we're looking to do as well. But hopefully we can also pick something out to help us understand the people of Israel. That's the title of this talk, that these Old Testament stories help us to understand the people of Israel in a better way. The people of Israel are our forebears. They're people who went before us. They are believers and unbelievers, and they are people who went before us. And it can be quite difficult sometimes to consider how different the world might be 3,000-4,000 years ago. And the question might be, if I can pose it, as to how hard it must be for us to consider when we look back to imagine what their life might have been like. How utterly different and almost unrecognizable things must have been for us to remember there. However, we are given these Testament stories, these Old Testament stories, to give us the meaning as well. These are relevant for us today as they were then. And we look at them through Sunday school and through our teenage years and all the way through to our non-teenage years. And we pick out messages and they reinforce our understanding of God and his message and his purpose with us. But helping to understand the people of Israel helps us understand the stories of individuals. Often enough, we get individual stories of great men and a few women who are there as examples for us. But often enough, what happens is that those great men and great women are there for a short period of time, and then they fall or die, and the people of Israel seemingly revert back to a wicked or unbelieving state, that there's a new person who comes along who leads them into God's ways again, and then they fall away again. And that cycle of belief and unbelief continues throughout the entire Old Testament, all the way through until we see slavery is imposed upon them and they are taken away into Babylon or Assyria, and the stories change again. We get those stories though throughout the picture to help us understand it, and David and Goliath feature within that. David and Goliath are stories that live with us today. They are a metaphor for somebody big and somebody small, and yet the power of the small beats the seemingly strength of the big. Something which can always give us hope. But as we look into the story, if you have got your Bibles open in 1 Samuel 17, I do want to pick out some of the elements within it. Not necessarily just where the battles are and that kind of stuff, but I would like to pick out that there's a fair bit of detail that we're given There's a lot of information we're given, particularly about the exact, almost the exact location of the battle. We are given a very detailed description of Goliath. There's a seeming there's probably about six or seven different verses where we are given description of this enemy, as well as verses elsewhere where we understand that he's one of a number of big fellas, and how we can we can see that elsewhere as well. But also we understand truly a lot more about Saul within this verse, within this chapter, because what we see is from verse 10 of chapter 17, the Philistine says, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Verse 11, when Saul and all Israel heard the words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now, 1 Samuel 17 is almost a culmination, a pattern through of how Saul, as king of Israel, holds himself in high regard. He is there to be the leader. He is picked because he is quite literally the tallest person in the country. He is head and shoulders above them all, but that his heart clearly isn't in it. He is, when he's first picked out by Samuel, he's picked out after herding down some donkeys, and he's anointed, and he doesn't seem to tell his dad about it, which is kind of a bit of a red flag. But then we get to see that as Saul progresses, he's quite weak. He's certainly not well made for it. And that is the pattern that we get to see that God is telling us as well. That is the pattern within the story of Saul, that this man that everyone looks to be a strong leader, a warrior, is not the best suited for leadership. That is the message that we are given through allegory and through analogy. And Saul himself is not directly criticized within the story of Goliath. He is there as being afraid, and we get to see his humanity, who he really is within that story. But then we get to see that where David's coming in. And now David is also noticed, he is a youngest of 12, and three of his eldest brothers have gone to war. So what does that really mean? And this is where I want to try and kind of pick out a little bit more of a story about it, because he's one of three. And as one of three, he would have, one of 12, and there's three that are there. The three that have gone off are the biggest, strongest brothers. But also because the nature of the people of Israel at the time would have been agrarian in nature. Their society was based around the harvest and around livestock. And everybody was required to be on hand to be able to look after the sheep or till the ground or collect the food in. And there would also be a time that the army went to war. And the army goes to war when it's dry and it's safe to do so. And the Philistines here have turned up and they've invaded Israel, and they've just sat there on one side of the valley and Israel on the other. And they're there for, well, it says 40 days, as to whether it's 40 actual days or whether that's just kind of code for a long time. Either way, Saul has his army ready to fight, but is afraid of it. He can't seemingly attack the Philistines for fear of a defeat. He can't send a champion out to face Goliath. And the Philistines are just sat in Judah's territory eating all their food, whilst the soldiers are taking people away from the farms. So they'd only be there for a period of time. This is a story that will continue all the way through many, many years, all the way through to even like Alfred the Great in England times. That's the kind of thing the Vikings would do as well. So it's a well-trodden path that we get to see here. So this is where David and Goliath give us an understanding about how the people of Israel are, because people need to be fed. The army marches on the stomach, said Napoleon, and it's certainly true. We get to see that within these verses too. So verse 14, David was youngest. The three eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So he's required to even leave his royal appointment as harpist at in Saul's palace to go back and forth to do his father's sheep tending at Bethlehem. And then Jesse, his father, sends him some food take a batch of food and take it up to your brothers. They've been there a long time. They haven't got any food left. So this is the nature of what's going on here. And this shows why Saul needed to have attacked, because he's just draining his own resources as well. David and Goliath tells us a story that helps us understand how the society as at large worked. Notice there aren't any young, other young people that are there. It seems that David is fairly clearly identified as being a young person within it. They all seem to be older than him. It's a story that gets him to go into the deepest, darkest parts of it. And we know that the story ends up with, because of his youth and because of his inexperience, he's seemingly picked because of his strength and his belief in God, that he will not allow this great uncircumcised Philistine to defeat and defy the armies of the Israelites and the people of Israel. David and Goliath give us this insight. They get this story is there. It gives us a better understanding of where Saul himself is. And it's not Saul that wins, it's David. And this is the beginning of the story of David here, really. This is where David becomes known to all the rest of the people. And this is the origin story of where he's coming from a people of Israel that will remember David for his greatness because of his belief in God, not because of Saul, who was their first king. So the story of David and Goliath gives us that information, and it gives us that kind of insight into how the society leads us to understand it. And we can only really get it when you read in between the lines. And when we can read these stories on the face value, and we can just see it's quite clearly a binary story of good versus evil, us versus them. But it's so much more to it. And this is just one example that when we can read these stories, particularly the way through the early parts of the Bible, where we're given this immense amount of detail into these tales, they are there for us to do. It's quite interesting as well that we get this written down. At some point, these were written down for us to be able to see as they are now. I'm not quite sure, or not necessarily agree with when they were written down. So I'd be interested on any viewpoints on that. But up to that point, these stories would be oral. They would be given as a story that would be told from one person to the next, that these messages would have been given, and they would have been told to others throughout their days, from old to young, so that this message could be continued. And that's how they were done in those days too. But equally, we get to see a lot more of the land, and we get to see a lot more of David's family, and it gives us a greater understanding of him as well. I could talk all night about David and Goliath, but I think I want to move on to the next one, because this is one that is particularly useful as well. So I'm going to talk about Jephthah. So when I talked about Jephthah, I wonder if a few of you were concerned that I might pick up the story of Jephthah and his daughter, and I'm not. I am going to go to Judges chapter 12, if you will please come with me to that as well. Judges chapter 12, and just a short few verses, really. So in the Judges period, prior to all the installation of Saul as the king of Israel, we get this Judges period where there's lots of judges going backwards and forwards, and periods of faith and then unbelief. And we see Jephthah as a judge that's been given to lead Israel for a period of time. And he has this tragic vow with his daughter. But then chapter 12, which leads up straight on from that, and I'll read these verses for us. So Judges 12, verses 1 to 6. The men of Ephraim were called to arms, and they crossed to Zaphon and said to Jephthah, "Why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites and did not call us to go with you? We will burn your house over you with fire." So the Ephraimites here are a bit cheesed off that they didn't get invited to have their fight. And so Jephthah says, "I and my people had a great dispute with the Ammonites, and when I called you, you did not save me from their hand. And when I saw that you would not save me, I took my life in my hand and crossed over against the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up against me to fight against me this day?" Then Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim. And the men of Gilead struck Ephraim because they said, "You are fugitives of Ephraim, Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and Manasseh." And the Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan against the Ephraimites. And when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, "Let me go over," the men of Egypt, men of Gilead asked him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" When he said no, they said to him, "Then say Shibboleth." And he said Sibboleth, for he could not pronounce it right. Then they seized him and slaughtered him at the fords of Jordan. And at that, 42,000 of the Ephraimites fell. So we get this word Shibboleth being given, and it's the only time that we get to see it in scripture. The word Shibboleth being used as a password to identify one set of people who are allowed to pass over to another. Those of you who might work in IT or in data solutions, the word Shibboleth is used as a password even to today as well, not as a password, you know, it's probably not minimum characters and things, but it's just a way to enable access into a enclosed space. So the word Shibboleth here is being used as a password to enable the people of Gilead to identify Ephraimites. And the reason I find this interesting, this is why I talked about it in excitations, I might have given it East, I can't remember. But anyway, this is an example of regional variation. The reason I find this interesting is because without looking at this and one other incident, we would believe that the people of Israel are exactly the same in every way from Dan to Beersheba. We would only get a clue that there is any regional differences in the people of Israel from stories such as this. So in this one, we get to see that the people of Ephraim cannot frame the sh noise, but can only say the s noise. So it's a accent or a dialectal issue that they have as Ephraim, that there's a group of people here which are known, distinctly known and renowned for having a speech peculiarity. I'm not sure if that's quite the right word. Characteristic, that's the proper word. The speech characteristic that means that they could only say sir, not sure. So my name would be really difficult because I'll be Andrew Semmold, which just sounds really wrong. It's not easy to say in the first place anyway. So Andrew Semmold is still my name, not Andrew Semmold. It would be a bit weird to say that. I suppose a local example might be that people from Coventry would stop friends from Birmingham crossing over the M42. That would be a sort of a similar kind of perception, maybe. I'm not sure how well that would go down. I'm not sure if anyone's from Birmingham here either, so I'll move on. So anyway, the story back in Judges is that they have this regional direction. The only other place that we know about that's very clear is that the people of Benjamin would be left-handed. And the people of Benjamin having a left-handedness is also how they're identified. It's, again, not clear if it means that every single person of Benjamin was left-handed. It seems a bit difficult to expect that every single one of them would be left-handed. But certainly those who were left-handed would be predominantly from the tribe of Benjamin. And it helps us understand it because, remember, we talked about the people of Israel being our forebears. And yet sometimes we can look back at them and imagine that they're exactly the same, that, as I said, anyone walking the length and breadth of the land would be able to speak their same language and be as understood as if they were at home. But even this, after a period of time, that after this is only a few hundred years after the return from Egypt, that these are people who have regional speech variations. And to the point where not only are they just on their the only people there, they are also known for it, helping us understand the deeper context around that these are people who would move around as well. That it wasn't you just don't stay in your own place. As we've seen before, sometimes war can be a factor within that. But also we know that the Levites would move around the country. How did they have a different way of speaking? How do we sound when we go out and we talk to other people, do our words help identify us as people of God? Does our, it might not be our accent, or that might be hard enough as it is, but do our words and our actions align to our Father? And do they identify us as people who can be trusted, who are clearly believers in God? Similarly, when it comes to a later stage, do our words enable us access over into the promised land? Because that's what's going on here, is that the Ephraimites are trying to cross back over. And because they don't speak, they didn't frame their word, they didn't talk, they talked in their own way, but they were identified and slaughtered. How can we therefore be identified by our speech, by our Lord and Master, and be picked out as followers of him too? Ephraim and Jephthah, as I said, a fascinating one for me. It's not really a really well-known story, but it's certainly one of the favourites, purely because it enables us to understand that difference. We don't know how they spoke. We haven't got any, of course, any recordings of them, and it would be fascinating to be able to hear how they phrased those words and how it impacted upon their day. Right, so what's the third story? So the third story was about the Samaritans. So the Samaritans we pick up from 2 Kings, and we're going to jump in at 2 Kings 17. And this is where we move on from the Old Testament into the New. So I did talk about how the Old Testament helps us understand the people of Israel, but we can't really understand the people of Israel without also looking in the New Testament. So 2 Kings 17, and first from verse 24 to 34, we get a little bit more information. This is late on in the kingdom period, and what's happened is that the northern 10 tribes of Israel have been defeated by Assyria, and the king of Assyria rules over that part of the land. He gets defeated in the south of Judah by Hezekiah, but here, so Assyria reigns supreme over most of the Palestinian and Judaic lands. So 2 Kings 17, verse 24, the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cuthar, Avar, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the people of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and lived in its cities. At the beginning of their dwelling there, they did not fear the Lord. Therefore, the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So the king of Assyria was told, "The nations that you have carried away and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the law of the God of the land. Therefore, he has sent lions among them, and behold, they are killing them, because they do not know the law of the God of the land." Then the king of Assyria commanded, "Send there one of the priests whom you carried away from there, and let him go and dwell there, and teach them the law of the God of the land." So one of the priests whom they carried away from Samaria came and lived in Bethel, and taught them how they should fear the Lord. But every nation still made gods of its own, and put them in the shrines of the high places that the Samaritans had made, every nation in the cities in which they lived. The men of Babylon made Succoth-Benoth, the men of Cuth made Nergal, the men of Hamath made Ashimah, and the Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak, and the Sepharvites burned their children in the fire to Adramelech and Anamelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. They also feared the Lord and appointed from among themselves all sorts of people as priests of the high places, who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. So they feared the Lord, but also served their own gods and the manner of the nations from among whom they had carried away. And there's one really, really interesting thing right in the middle of that, which I don't know if you read it, if you noticed it as I was reading along. There's a really interesting thing that, because the kingdom of Israel was a land that did not follow God. There was no good kings in the northern kingdoms. There was no king that followed God at all. And so they went so far as to set up their own gods. So verse 28, when Assyria sends one of the priests whom they carried away from Samaria, that priest came into Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. Where does that come from? Where is it that priest has come from Samaria, a land where nothing seemingly worshipped God, and they had their own wickedness and they did their own thing, and yet taught them how to fear the Lord. Well, I think there's two answers. One is that this priest was maybe not from Samaria in the first place, and he came from elsewhere and then into Samaria, or that there was still a low level amount of people who followed the Lord in Israel in the north. Now, this is I am putting subjection into it to be able to understand how we could otherwise consider how there would be a priest from Samaria who taught them seemingly correctly how they should fear the Lord without knowing how that was. Now, whether that means that priest just knew about it or whether he believed it himself, but he is referred to here as being a priest who taught the people how to fear the Lord as a seemingly answer for having loads of lions coming along and eating them all. So the people, therefore, people who became Samaritans would therefore be also able to serve the Lord and their own. So they're in the middle. They are a persecuted people that we see in the New Testament. They are people who are hated by everyone else. They are not as original Israelites as the rest of the people would have liked them to be, but they have also been taught how to understand God. And if that's not an analogy for us, I don't know how, what else it could be. We are not natural followers. We are not natural children of Israel. We are there by inheritance because of our faith. And as forerunners of us, we also remember that people there had some benefit for us, because we can see, as we will go into slightly, the Good Samaritan being a neighbor as well. But there is some messages for us here too. We talked about that connection. We talk about those things there that we can look at that. Yes, I mean, I'm not suggesting that we go and burn our children by any stretch of the imagination, but we are also under an impression that we can come to our God because of our faith that we've learned from people who are not natural land, not people of the land originally. So verse 34, they do this to this day. They do not fear the Lord, and they do not follow the statutes or the rules of the commandments about the Lord. So we separate on that part, but we don't sometimes, do we? Sometimes we fall, we sin. We are not always there. We don't always follow the law, the commandment of the Lord. That's the purpose of our relationship with God too, that we know that we sin and we fall away, and we try our best to come back again and ask for forgiveness. But Samaritans, as we see within the New Testament, that we get to see how the continuation of how stories are part and parcel of the society. Because Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan, the good neighbor that is there to be contrasted with those who are the priests and the Levites, those who are trained to look after the sick and the weary, those who are identified as being pure and separate and holy. And yet they pass by on the other side, and they leave the man injured and weary. And yet the Samaritan stops at risk of his own life and helps the man through his injuries, puts him on his donkey and cares for him. And it's sometimes the way that we tell that story of the Good Samaritan, we can also imagine the Samaritan being Jesus within that story. Certainly for us who might be weak and weary and battered, we need a Good Samaritan such as Jesus. And also we also try to be that Good Samaritan, that we try to step away from it. And we try to put ourselves in that position which Jesus would do and care for the needy, those who are weak and injured. And we try our best to do that too. So it's also the message that the parable story of Samaritans, about how the New Testament also picks out these people as being separate and different, but in a bad way. We get to see the discrimination that the people of Israel displayed towards the Samaritans. And we can also hopefully live in our day today where we may look back on these people who lived 2,000 years ago and think, well, we're better than them. And I truly hope that at least we have learned from them. If not, I would not like to think that we're better than anyone else. But certainly we can look at them and think we have learned from their mistakes. We can therefore look at about how maybe we face and we deal with discrimination when we see it, and how we see people being treated differently accordingly as well. So there's plenty of things that the Samaritans pick out for us. And the last one, which I didn't put on the start slide, was about your story. Because in all of this that we've talked about, well, how is it relevant for you and how is it relevant for me? Well, each one of these stories that we've picked out has some message for us to have as well, and a deeper meaning. And I'm hopeful that we can kind of finish this with a little bit of self-reflection and introspection within that too. Because when we turn to Revelation chapter 21, Revelation 21, right, almost right at the end of the Bible, we get to see a new book opened. Maybe not a story as such, but certainly a book that is used with a deeper connection. So Revelation chapter 21. For Revelation 21, I won't read all of it because it's a lovely, lovely book, but it talks about how the new heavens and the new earth has come down, that the new creation is there, that that all of the world has been, the old world has been done away with, and the new world is there to be taken and to be given to those who are faithful and true. And verse 22 of Revelation 21, I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. And the city has no need of sun or moon to shine in it, for the glory of God gives its light, and the lamp is the Lamb. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. And its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. They'll bring into it the glory and the honor of the nations. But nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life. And that is why I want to reflect on our own path and our own journey too, because there is a book that the Lamb is depicted here as having, the book of life, who has the names of the righteous written within it. And our story from when we started to learn of God and our journey through our understanding has been that we might pray that we might be listed within that book too, that the book is one that our story can be written. But also when we pick out the power of the stories that we've also gone through already, the power of the stories that we each have, where whoever we are and wherever we come from, we've got a story that can help really other people understand faith because of your experiences, that we get to tell our stories to the young people or the people that we know. And in the those who've done preaching or worked in that kind of area, having the ability to tell your story to somebody else is one of the most powerful conversion abilities that we have. But also the ability to hear their story, to hear where they've come from, help build us up and give us a bit more of a reality check too. It helps build the connections by sharing our stories and hearing other people's. Our connections are renewed and we get to see God working through other people in the stories that they tell. We also get to hear how that message of God's purpose and plan comes to fruition in the things that we can't explain and the things that we can see God working in them too. And when we can tell our story to others who are looking for hope and expectation, that message can be infinitely powerful to a world that is dark and that we need to give them the light. And the final part that I listed is that deeper meaning. But I hope that wherever we go, that we can see the deeper meaning that God does have that plan and purpose, that God does give us a opportunity to be writing our names, if that's the metaphor, to have our names in the book of life, that our stories can be included, but also that we can change our story, that steps that we've taken that we might want to consider and reconsider can be refreshed and renewed, and that our story can be there so that that book of life can be continued and other people can hear our stories, just as we read the stories of these faithful men and women from thousands of years ago. So hopefully you can see that because also we are part of that children of Israel too, that we are the extension of the stories that have happened before, that we are now the modern day version of them. we hope that we can also see that the Old Testament stories that lead to us as that children of Israel today are because of our faith, not because of our heritage, but that also our faith leads us into the kingdom we get to see. As I said, thank you very much for listening to me. I've enjoyed talking about it, and hopefully you've enjoyed listening too.